Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got Chris Versace, Mary Grant, and Evan Brown joining me. Google's Y-Spy lawsuit is going to go forward. That could be a big deal. Fingerprints everywhere, all over your iPhone. We're going to talk about the distinction, the fine distinction between fine champagne and other sparkling beverages of various colors, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 227, recorded September 13th, 2013. Twitter breaks out the bubbly. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWIL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thanks so much for joining us for This Week in Law. It's been an incredible week, and things are happening even as we speak as far as interesting developments in law and technology. So we're going to get right to them, give you a little bit of our analysis and thoughts on what's unfolding right here and now. And to help us doing that, we've got a wonderful guest this week, Mary Grant from Grant Law. Hello, Mary.
Hey, Denise. Great to be here.
Great to meet you. You're just up the road from me in Pasadena, lovely Pasadena, California.
Yep.
Getting all geared up for the UCLA football.
Yeah, exactly. My daughter's school actually closes on those days.
It's because it's so close to the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm certainly getting back into the swing of college football season. How about you, Evan? Are you looking forward to fall and pigskins?
Yeah, I like college football for what it's worth. I'm more of an NFL guy. So, being in Chicago, got the Bears, you know, but my teams are the Broncos and the Colts, being, you know, at the other places I've lived. So, yeah, but I like college football for what it's worth. And it's a great time of year. But even better to be spending a Friday afternoon talking with the two of you. Really looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Me too. And of course, this is Evan Brown, co-host of This Week in Law from the Info Law Group. And as he said, Chicago, Illinois. So how's life in Chicago?
Things are going great. You know, it's finally turning into fall here. And, you know, it's just there's always interesting things going on with the practice of law, especially in this area. New things happening all the time. So everything's all good.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's get right into some privacy stories. And I think just about everything we're going to talk about this week has some sort of privacy angle to it. So let's get to that first. Let's start out with the iPhone, shall we? And whether or not fingerprint authentication is a good idea or a privacy concern. Lots of people are hand-wringing, no pun intended, about Apple's announcement that the new iPhones will feature biometric authentication in order to gain access to the phone. Now, I'm assuming I did not watch the announcement when it happened earlier this week. I've just been following along with the aftermath. And I'm assuming that having your phone locked by a fingerprint will be an option, not a requirement, much as the same way that the phones currently now can lock with a passcode or not, if you'd prefer not to go that route. It's sort of a good news, bad news scenario, I suppose. It might be more secure than a password that could be cracked, and yet people are a bit concerned about whether this is even an effective way of securing one's phone. And if it is, you know, splashing your fingerprint data all over the place and potentially into databases that can be matched up with your identity is causing a good deal of concern. Although it seems like people may be making assumptions that might not necessarily be true about the technology. Evan, do you think that Apple is getting itself into a legal hornet's nest here?
Not really. I mean, this is not unpredictable. We should have seen this coming. You know, fingerprint scanners are nothing new. Using biometric data to authenticate users is nothing new. If the iPhone 5S and 5C announcements had had more to them other than this wouldn't be a big deal. You know, the phones themselves really aren't all that transforming. There's certainly nothing revolutionary in the technology or the interface. Besides this, or you know, I'm not even saying this is revolutionary. So they're clearly, you know, using this type of information to authenticate in this manner of security certainly lends itself to discussion about security and the risks that are attendant to it. But I don't see that there's going to be a big problem here. What the initial response that a lot of people had, and this is just something that happens naturally in this environment that we live in right now, is to think, oh my gosh, my fingerprint data is going to be associated with my identity and then put into a big database in the sky somewhere that the NSA is going to have access to. And, you know, that's the easiest and the biggest concern that we have about this. That concern seems to be taken away with right away just from the technical perspective of that's not what's going on here. And even if it were, it sounds like I've read some commentary out there that saying, you know, the manner of the way that the biometric data is looked at and the way that the information in the fingertip as it touches the display is matched up against a template doesn't provide as rich a set of information as what is in the FBI database on 70 million individuals already, the way it is. So, you know, it gives us a lot of really interesting things to talk about. There's some low-hanging fruit. The most interesting thing to me is the theoretical question of what this would mean to this question that we talk about a lot on the show, or at least from time to time, about this Fifth Amendment issue of self-incrimination, of having to authenticate something, because this is not like giving up a password. This is using information to authenticate that may already be in the hands of the authorities. So yes, lots of things to talk about. I don't think it's a huge deal. Nothing that anybody should be losing any sleep over.
Well, let's assume for a moment that your fingerprints somehow aren't already in the hands of the authorities. And I think, you know, as you were discussing, Evan, that may be a difficult thing to assume, but let's assume that for a second. And you found yourself in the situation that we've talked about a lot on the show, where you have a device that's encrypted with your biometric signature, and the only way to decrypt it is to provide that signature, and you say, I'm not going to do it because it violates my Fifth Amendment rights. What do you think a court would do as far as compulsion, since we've seen different results on the question of providing decryption passwords?
I think that it would be much easier for the government to get that information, and that information being your fingerprint information, because case law goes back many, many years saying that there's nothing wrong with gathering the fingerprint data from a person who's being arrested. So that right there, there is no compulsion that I see. If clearly the law allows the authorities to get that fingerprint data, that's tantamount to getting the password, but it's not for the same purpose. It's for a completely inarguably valid purpose of just having this information on hand. So it presents a real problem. To the extent that we should be concerned about the government having more access to encrypted data, there's certainly something to that. But again, that's only for getting at information in the local environment that's actually stored on the phone. I think that sets aside this larger issue of having just this universal fingerprint database out there that is just open to the government authorities for no reason at all.
Mary, what do you think about the Fifth Amendment issue or any other legal issues around fingerprint authentication?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the phone is going to start to be a little bit more like your house, where if they can get into your house and find your, you know, what you're in possession of in your home. It'd be very similar, I think, if all they need is a fingerprint to get into your phone. The extra layer of protection maybe that people think that they have because of not, in some cases, not being able to be forced to give up the password is probably not going to be there. I think, though, that that's fairly easy to address if you had a concern like that. You would just start encrypting the data on your phone separately and not relying on what's essentially, you know, a different version of a password. You would, you know, use an app or something like that to separately encrypt the stuff that's on your phone. You could, you know, password protect that separately, and that wouldn't be unlocked with your fingerprint. So I would think, I do think it opens up devices in a way that we're not used to having them be open, but it seems like if you really wanted to, you know, kind of cut that back off again, it's not that hard to do.
Right. It's easy to pick out all of the difficulties with using fingerprint authentication. For example, I've been reading that some people don't have fingerprints that are usable for this kind of purpose. If they work a lot with their hands, you can actually wear down your fingerprints. Cory Doctorow on the other end of the spectrum is writing that pretending that a fingerprint is a secure way, a way of securing a device that makes any sense is sort of ludicrous since you leave your fingerprints all over the place. He had a great quote, unless you never venture into public without a clean room bunny suit, mirror shades, and sharp gravel in your shoes, you're not going to be able to stop dedicated strangers from capturing these measurements. So, you know, kidding yourself that that kind of thing might be secure is an issue. But I foresee a whole lot of people liking this more, notwithstanding the privacy considerations, than the password system because it's easier. You don't have to come up with and remember passwords. You know, unless you're living in a science fiction and or gruesome fictional world where people will sever off your limbs in order to gain access to your biometric signatures. You pretty much have that with you and you're not going to forget it. What was the movie you were thinking in our pre-show discussion, Mary?
Species.
Species, that's right.
Where the reptile alien woman fakes a car crash in order to get a finger from somebody and to get into some, you know, high security environment. Bugged me right. All day yesterday. So you guys called that.
and you see that scenario kind of underscores really why this isn't a huge issue for the vast majority of people. That was a high security database that had really important stuff in it. Yes, the information that's on our iPhones is important, but unless you're, you know, a very, very special person, and most of us aren't very, very special people when in this context here, there's really no reason for a criminal to undertake a whole lot of efforts to access that. So I'm not coming up with this commentary originally. It's in a lot of the commentary that's out there already. It bolsters this idea that the real value to this is in the convenience of it. And in any event, I think it would be, you know, notwithstanding what Cory Doctorow says, I mean, this is not the first time that Cory Doctorow has ever overstated anything. You know, yes, your fingerprints are out there, and you know they're anybody with a modicum of curiosity and motivation to get your fingerprint could do that, but that's very separate and apart from reconstructing it in a biomorphic reality. So that you could actually use it to authenticate yourself as a user of the phone. Kind of forget where I'm going with this, but I guess it's to underscore the convenience of it all. It in some ways it is more secure. It certainly does lend itself to insecurity, but on balance, it does seem to be a good progression forward without a whole lot of negative baggage to weigh it down. And I see the technology being adopted.
It's also better than what a lot of us do, which, you know, a lot of us have files and, you know, I'm sure I don't know what this is all about, but I've heard that a lot of us have little files on our computers with all of our passwords because there are too many to remember. And yes. So, you know, while the idea of having your fingerprint maybe being out there, or even if I lose my phone, then, you know, someone's got an image of my fingerprint because they've got my phone. That's probably really a lot less creepy than the idea that if they manage to have my computer or my phone and get in there, they have my passwords for everything.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that iDevices actually store the unlock password somewhere on the device in a hidden little file that, you know, you have to download some app to extract it. And I only know this because I've forgotten a parental restrictions password on one of our devices that I need to be able to unlock and update now that my child is older. And it's just gone. We're either going to, it's on the device, but it's now in a corrupt file that we can't access, even though I've done everything that you need to do to access that. So it's frustrating. If I had a fingerprint scanner option, I could just put that on there, but it's arguably less secure. And you, don't go knocking Corey for overstating things. I don't make me go back through the show archives and pull out a couple of whoppers of yours, Evan.
But,
we're all prone to that from time to time.
Sure. And you know what? People are quick to call me out on it too. So I feel perfectly accountable. You know, go on. I'm not going to say that's enough for all that.
That's enough. I'm glad Corey thinks in terms of hyperbole because it definitely adds to his fiction and to, you know, the way we think about things too. Let's see. Mary, I wanted to ask you before we leave this, if your concerns about, you know, we referred to the database problem that, you know, another database that matches your fingerprints to your identity. If given that Apple says the fingerprints won't be in a database, they'll be local on the device. Does that address your concern on that front?
Yeah, I think so. I think that having everything in one place where it seems much more hackable or much more backdoorable or however it's going to be gotten seems like a bigger concern. And obviously the government's already got a whole lot of that anyway, so I assume you'd go there. So if you were looking to get a large collection of fingerprints, it still does strike me as a little weird that my fingerprint's on my phone if I lose it, but my actual fingerprint to the point of everybody on IRC is probably on the phone anyway when I lose it, if you were really looking for that. It's probably there just on the outside instead of the inside.
It's almost like phones are designed to be fingerprint repositories.
Absolutely.
Just in case, you know, you need to access them in some way. What were you going to say, Evan?
Well, maybe we need to be a little bit careful. I mean, we have what Apple has told us, that it's only stored locally and it's not being phoned home to the mothership somewhere. But, you know, we've been surprised in the past when it comes, this is not just Apple, this was in the Android environment too. Remember, this has probably been a couple of years ago where those security researchers actually found that there was all this, you know, location data being stored. I can't remember exactly the contours of all that, but I remember there was just this huge controversy about it because it really went against the expectations that people had about where their location data was being stored. And so we can't take these, what would you call assurances that it's just in the purely local environment at face value. I hope that these assertions really are being given some scrutiny and, you know, that there are people out there who make it their whole ambition to look for these types of security things. So let's just hope that everything is true, what we're hearing from Apple on this.
Right. It seems like way too often we hear those kinds of assurances from companies and then there's some sort of rogue employee or some sort of accidental technical glitch where, whoops, it turned out we really were storing everything. Sorry, sorry about that.
What was the name of that company that was in cahoots with the carriers? I mean, it was like this huge controversy and there was... Do you remember what I'm talking about? There were some class action lawsuits filed that I, of course, made fun of at the time. I'm hopefully somebody in IRC will come out. This was a couple years ago.
Yeah, the cellular carriers.
Yeah, do you remember?
Yeah. It's ringing a bell now, but you're right. It was a few years ago, and it's totally slipped my mind. We'll have to look it up after the show.
I heard you say ring a bell too when we were talking about carriers. So yes. I think they broke up.
they did. So speaking of, you know, what people expect will be done with their data, that seemed to be a big consideration for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in considering whether people can sue Google over another thing that happened a few years ago now, where the Google Street View cars were driving around and instead of just taking nice photos of things and people, We're scooping up data such as information from people's open Wi-Fi networks. Initially, those lawsuits were not permitted to go forward. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal has said, oh yeah, they can, because actually what people are doing on those networks are not akin to radio transmissions, which is what Google was trying to hang its legal argument on. The Ninth Circuit went through and said, no, the things that people are doing on those networks are much more things that they, in which they have an expectation of privacy, even if they have not locked them down. And Google's argument that unencrypted data is easily accessible, there are tools out there that allow you to, you know, you can just buy them off the shelf, as it were. That didn't save Google. So it seems like a very large lawsuit with lots of affected possible plaintiffs is going to go forward, and that this could result in a pretty big determination. Now, the plaintiffs are seeking $10,000 per violation in a class action suit. Those sorts of damages for this kind of loss hardly ever happen. We've been talking recently about the Facebook newsfeed issue that has settled and is going to result in maybe a $15 payment out to the various class plaintiffs there, class members there. So, Evan, what do you think about this suit? Is this going to be a big deal?
Well, it's interesting, you know, from those of us who enjoy thinking about the Wiretap Act and, you know, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and all of its contours and the different ways it can be violated. And it's interesting in as much as it's taking this old statute, relatively speaking, from, you know, the its origins come from the 1980s, looking at it in the modern context where Google was doing something innovative and from all indications, you know, didn't intend to do anything bad here. I don't think we should see any, I don't think there's any reason we should conclude that they were trying to use this payload data nefariously. And by payload data, I mean like the actual content of emails and passwords and stuff that were, that was being transmitted over these Wi-Fi networks as they were driving through neighborhoods, taking pictures. So, but you know, from a more practical level, you know, where, you know, down here in reality, outside of just the theoretical manner of thinking about these things, it's just to tack on what you were saying and add some color to that. You know, this is really only going to benefit the plaintiffs, class action lawyers in the end. It doesn't look like anybody was really damaged by this. I'm not saying that Google shouldn't be responsible, because the larger issue and the larger public concern issue is that companies be careful when they're innovating not to advertently or inadvertently gather data that's not needed and put people's privacy at risk. So my default setting is to be disdainful of large plaintiff class action, you know, large class action lawsuits brought by plaintiffs for this, because I think they mostly benefit the lawyers. But in this situation, it's an important lesson to be learned by Google and by anybody else who would choose to do something like this in the future, in the course of a future innovation.
So the Supreme Court likes to undo things that the Ninth Circuit has done. I don't know that we're looking at a situation that would make this a likely candidate for review by the United States Supreme Court, because we don't have a circuit split on the issue. But it could be something that the court decides to get interested in. You know, they can pretty much do what they want when someone knocks on their door. If they think it's an important enough issue, they can take it up. Mary, do you think, here's what makes me think that maybe, you know, a Supreme Court clerk could write up something that could get the justices to buy into looking at this issue, is the public nature of the data in question. When it's unencrypted and out there, why is it any different than, you know, you or I walking around in a public place? In that circumstance, anybody can take our photograph, and as long as we don't have any special reason to believe that what we're doing or where we are is a private place. We're out there. Why isn't this data just out there?
Yeah, and I wonder if the Street View data that had been gathered while I'm sitting in a coffee shop using, you know, kind of a widely available unencrypted Wi-Fi or a Wi-Fi where I might even know that the provider is gathering my information, you know, for reasons of targeting ads or whatever, would that setting have possibly generated a different result? So if I'm using my Wi-Fi at home and it's kind of easy to crack my Wi-Fi security when I'm at home, I'm still at home. And, you know, just like I can use a telephoto lens to get a picture of somebody inside their home, you know, that can still be an invasion of privacy, even if I was standing in a public part of the street when I did it. I feel like there should be that same principle maybe be applied here when you're in your home using your Wi-Fi. But what if I'm in my firm using my Wi-Fi? And if I've been sloppy and I haven't protected it, or the protection is really easy to crack, then in that case, is there some sort of expectation of privacy or some sort of protectable interest there? I would think that might be one place that you drill in if you wanted to limit this or, you know, try and undo this this decision.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see if they move for en banc hearing.
Yes, the home is kind of a magic place as far as courts are concerned. The curtilage of the home is like a sacrosanct barrier that thou shalt not cross. So I don't know, Evan, do you think that would make a difference? We're not talking about law enforcement here.
I think it makes a difference in our common sense way of thinking about these things. I don't think it would persuade a court to decide it differently because it was... the Ninth Circuit was constrained to look at the language of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act here. So, but this isn't the only example of, you know, when we talk about privacy in the everyday world where we mean something different than what the law will recognize as privacy. So that, you know, is a great idea to bring into the discussion of how these laws could make more sense. You know, does it, I mean, because really, if we're looking at the purpose of laws like this and what they're supposed to protect us from and what kind of interests they're supposed to give us, what kind of privacy interests, it really does depend on the context in which the communication is being made. You know, Mary sitting at her law office should be able to expect a different level of privacy for all kinds of reasons than in different contexts. And that's what's important rather than the means of the technology that she's using to do that. But I don't see that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act has anywhere in its language, particularly with this one exception for communications that are readily acceptable to the public. It doesn't give any reality to that distinction that we draw in our minds of what the expectation of privacy should be. So maybe it's one of those things that'll change.
Okay, well, also in interesting lawsuit news, Yahoo has jumped into the fray with other companies who are suing to be able to disclose how many requests they get from the NSA for data in the name of transparency and in the name of salvaging their image, which prompted Mary to have an interesting question about liability related to backdoors that companies either have agreed to or have been forced to provide for the government. Mary, why don't you flesh that out for us?
Sure. I have a number of clients that provide platform services, and as they're negotiating their deals, they're often asked to, you know, step up to sometimes a completely unlimited liability if there's a breach of data security of the data that they're storing for their clients. And, you know, we won't usually have any success carving out hackers that our clients, the clients usually say, well, that's exactly who we want you to protect our data from. But it did strike me that in these clauses that are written in a very kind of strict liability kind of way, whether you've been forced to give information to the government or whether, say, your data is hosted on a service that has, you know, it's been cooperative in providing information to the NSA or whoever, whether or not my clients would be really susceptible to having that strict liability kick in if the party that the unauthorized disclosure was made to was the NSA. And in sort of a smart alecky way, but in sort of a serious way, I've started to wonder whether or not we should put that in something like the force majeure clause, or as an explicit carve out to that liability that, you know, if I let, you know, Joe Hacker, who's sitting in a garage trying to steal your credit card number, get your data, okay, you know, I'll protect you from that, or I'll try and, you know, pay you for the damages for that. But if it's, you know, some dude in Washington in the NSA who's gotten a hold of your data, then, you know, I'm not going to protect you from those costs. Just, to me, an interesting question.
It is an interesting question. Can you explain for people who are neither lawyers nor fluent in Latin what force majeure is?
Ah, okay. Sorry, I did say force majeure. So the force
you know that every time anybody talks Latin on here, we have to drink. So thank you.
Yes.
Well, is it? I think it's French. Do we get to drink twice?
Yes. We think to
everyone. Oui, oui.
Perhaps we shall have some champagne.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's right. Wink, wink. That is the clause in a contract that says I get let off the hook if I breach the contract or if I'm really slow in performing my obligations because there's some crazy event. Often it's, you know, weather or some sort of, you know, cataclysmic catastrophe that keeps me from complying. So if I was supposed to do something for you today and there's an earthquake in California and I can't perform, I'm not in breach of the contract. I get a little bit of a pass for that. And force majeure clauses lately have included things like failure of the internet. You know, if I'm hosting my service somewhere and that service goes down and it's a third party hosting service, maybe that should be an exception. It's not really within my control. And so, riots, other things like that, kind of people induced events are often included in those kinds of clauses. And I think it'd be a kick to see what people said if we stuck something in there that said, you know, a force majeure is, you know, the federal government insisting on access to your data that I can't control.
I think it's more than a kick. I think you've got to start doing it. I think lawyers are definitely going to start doing this. Evan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Certainly the issue is real and it's of concern. And one of the things that we could think about, I think we could think about it in terms of force majeure. You also see language in most confidentiality agreements where it's not a violation of this obligation of non-disclosure to turn over the information pursuant to a valid court order or a subpoena or what have you. But most of those clauses don't end right there. They go on to say, provided that the recipient gives the disclosing party enough time to go in and get a protective order to stop that disclosure. And so that is problematic here because disclosure to the NSA, the very fact of that is secret. So it would make it ineffectual to have that provision in a confidentiality agreement say everything that it does in the ordinary course because, you know, therein lies the problem. You can't even tell people about the fact that you're having to turn this information over. So it's a real and it's a tough problem, and it puts platforms like Mary's talking about in a difficult position.
Well, we'll definitely make force majeure, which is spelled F-O-R-C-E, M-A-J-E-U-R, if I'm not mistaken, our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're listening to the show for legal education credit or other professional education credit, we put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate to any board oversight kind of board that you've actually listened to the show. So we'll drop another one in a little further down the road here. And if you'd like more information about MCLE or other kinds of professional credit for listening to or watching TWIL, go to wiki.twit.tv, find the This Week in Law page, and there's lots more information over there. Let us move now to, where did I want to go next? Oh, I wanted to just mention that I think Peter Biddle had an interesting discussion about this whole cooperating with government entities to give access to your data. And I think when we had Peter on the show, he actually may have scooped this Mashable piece that he was written up in this week. Because didn't he talk with us, Evan, about BitLocker and how he was approached to provide backdoors?
Yes. Yeah. And isn't he a cool guy? I mean, just the stuff he says and the way he says it is really funny, because I liked what he said there. You know, he was recounting a time where he was talking with, and, you know, he claims that he couldn't remember which agencies it was, but that's in the cool Peter Biddle kind of way. Oh, you know, I don't remember. It was probably, you know, an FBI agent. He says, you're, you know, expletive, you're giving us the shaft here. And he says, no, we're just commoditizing the shaft. That's yes. just such a funny thing to say. And that's so his style. He's a cool guy. It was fun having him on the show, and interesting to see this stuff coming out now.
Yes. And if you would like to see more, Peter was, of course, at Microsoft quite some time ago, and was one of the people trying to work on encryption for data at a very early stage in the proceedings. Head on over to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/227. And the Mashable story, did the FBI lean on Microsoft for access to its encryption software, as well as links to everything else we are discussing this week, will be right there at your disposal. So let's move now, if we can, to the social web. So speaking of government agencies knowing what we're doing, whether or not we've given them access or backdoors, what have you, a California school district has announced that it is doing round-the-clock monitoring of its students' social media activities, presumably all it can monitor without people's passwords or specific friend authorization is the material that they are making publicly available. Is this problematic, Evan?
Unsurprisingly, there's hand-wringing over it. You know, I mean, if you see it on Tech Dirt, there's going to be you know, plenty to say about it. And you know, and it's so here again, it's bringing up this question of what does privacy mean in the modern world, and in the ordinary run-of-the-mill outcry of this is, you know, my gosh, these poor kids, the school district is watching them all the time. They can't do anything without, you know, being watched and monitored. But a couple of interesting points on that. This is a service that monitors public social media information, and we don't know what the school's plans are to actually do with the information that it has. The law already gives us some guidance as to, you know, whether and to what extent the school district could discipline students for what they say in social media. There's this is kind of a First Amendment. This is a First Amendment issue. Leading case on that is from the 60s called Tinker. And unless there's a disruption that actually enters into the school environment and disrupts the actual learning process, the discipline for what happens on social media is a violation of the First Amendment. So there's a free speech issue, there's a privacy issue, but really I don't think it's much of a legal privacy issue. Going back to that distinction I was drawing earlier, what the law will recognize as private is different than what we ordinarily think of as private. There's been a whole long it's a large body of case law that's developed in the last few years as to what's the evidentiary value of information that people post to social media. And, you know, that's, you know, there's the Steele case. And there's been a couple of cases from New York and Pennsylvania that have been made it very clear that stuff you put on social media, even if it's protected by privacy settings, is not private in the legal sense. So, so I had an interesting conversation with a couple of folks on Twitter about this, and their big concern, which I think is well founded, is that this will have an interesting unintended consequence of moving. This will have an interesting unintended consequence of moving student communications into private channels, underground, so to speak, to make it more difficult for the school administration to accomplish the end that it seeks to do here, which, let's just give them the benefit of the doubt at this point. They're trying to monitor students to make sure that they're not getting into trouble and so that they can provide a safe school environment. You know, we can scrutinize that as we may, you know, in the future, or we can be as incredulous about that as we want. But in any event, if that is the objective, moving the communications underground is not going to further that objective. So it's an interesting story that gives us some things to talk about.
It does. And it seems that this is the Glendale School District, and they're contracting with a company called GeoListening to survey the social media accounts of its various student body. So it seems to me like the school district is taking the same sort of approach that the NSA takes. You know, we may not need this information, but, you know, we're going to create a database. And if something comes up, then we'll be able to delve in further. This isn't too far from Pasadena, the Glendale School District. Mary, is this something that would concern you if your child were one of these students?
Yeah, you're right. It's very close. Just just down the road. It wouldn't concern me that they were looking at the information, because if my daughter was being bullied and somebody managed to notice that before, you know, I happened to, because I have full intention of spying on my children's social media, which I tell them when I give them their accounts. But that part doesn't disturb me so much. I would have some really practical questions, though. You know, I surfed around a little bit on GeoListening site. I'd love to know how long they're planning to keep that information sitting around on their servers. And same with the school district. If my kid is saying stupid things on Facebook and tries to clean that up later, it would be nice to know that there weren't little, you know, kind of hard to find and hard to remember repositories of that stuff somewhere other than you would expect. So that'd be one question I would have. I'd also wonder, from the school district's perspective, whether they ought to be worried about being put on notice for things that they then failed to prevent. I'm sure they've thought of that. I'm sure, you know, that wasn't a compelling enough concern to overcome what I assume, you know, is a genuine desire to keep an eye out for kids in trouble. But I do think that would be, you know, something to think about, at least. You know, once you've got this data, are you really obligated then to make sure that you're trying to sift through it and trying to take action if something bad's about to happen and you could stop it?
Right. And it's just another reminder, too, that for parents to educate their children that what they put on social media is not just between themselves and their friends, that, you know, as long as the settings are public, then their school can listen in, law enforcement can listen in, the parents, of course, can listen in, and they should just be aware of that. I just heard on Twitter, this is for Alex in the studio, that our other guest who was lined up for this week, he had some power issues in his area. He is back online, Alex, and available on Skype if we want to go ahead and add him in. This is Chris Versace of Power Talk and the Power Trend Brief. So we'll see if we can get him on with us. And in the meantime, while Alex hopefully can make some efforts along those lines, let's take a break. We're here with Mary Grant for the time being of Grant Law, and Evan Brown and me, and we are discussing a whole lot of privacy and monitoring related stories this week, but we've got even more on deck, including the various trademark implications of making something champagne colored. We're going to get to all that in a little bit here. But first, we would like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ProXPN. And what a great time to bring up ProXPN, given what we've been discussing here today, because it's a global VPN, a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, your email. If you are someone who streams a lot of video in your home and you're concerned about that data getting scooped up, somehow breaking into your Wi-Fi network and getting access to that data, this is something you might want to look into. Instant messaging programs work with it, all sorts of messaging, and really any web traffic that you're involved in at all can be secured by ProXPN. It keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes. It disguises your physical location and gives you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So if you're somebody who can't be bothered to lock down your Wi-Fi connection, ProXPN is definitely something you might want to look into the next time you see the Google Street View car cruising by. Of course, they're not doing that anymore, so I'm saying that tongue in cheek. But certainly topical for what we've been discussing today and the concerns that come up when you're doing things that you would rather keep private in an online way. And the reason that it works is that it gives you a 512-bit encryption tunnel for all your data. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose which one you prefer. You can protect yourself against your ISP's six-strike rule if you don't want to get caught up in that red tape, even if you're doing completely legitimate activities on your network. You can keep your personal internet usage private at work, and you can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites. Also, geographical restrictions for internet content and online video will be bypassed as well. ProXPN has worldwide servers in the United States, the UK, Asia, and more. It also makes your internet connection region-free, which is very handy when you're traveling. Its software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. There's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. There's world-class customer support, and Steve Gibson loves this product. If you want to hear his entire rundown of how it works, why it works, why it's worthwhile, go find Security Now, episode 400. And you'll get the whole spiel from Steve. And also what you should do is go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN.com premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for the entire year. But don't pay that. We've got a better offer for you. Use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and you'll get 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. Not too bad. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TWIL, T-W-I-L. Thank you so much, ProXPN, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so let us move on to what I was talking about, champagne-colored iPhones. Of course, although it hasn't really helped Apple out in the stock department, or really added a whole lot of heft to its iPhone announcements this week, one of the things it did announce was that various colors of the iPhone will be available, including a champagne color. But the folks in Champagne, France are not so happy about that. Evan, how on earth can they have a trademark in the word champagne?
Well, I think that's something that's pretty well established. It's one of those weird geographical, that whole origin, geographical origin thing with trademark law. Champagne's kind of acquired this special distinction as standing for the particular product. So, you know, it leaves me scratching my head, though, here, wondering how it's extrapolated itself into this untenable situation. If we look at we got to back up as usual in these types of situations and look at what the interest at stake is here. And it's consumer confusion. Is anybody really thinking that Apple is, creating these products in a way that's going to confuse people as to where they come from? Are we supposed to think that they come from that region in France and that it's somehow related to the champagne industry, you know, the bubbly spirit, you know, the bubbly, you know, white wine, whatever. I'm trying to use the generic term for it. It just goes to, when we talk about champagne, it's champagne. So, it's not the first time this kind of dispute has happened. But why is this an issue? It seems kind of silly. So, you know, that's pretty much all I can say about it.
So they can't ban the actual use of the color. I wonder if they've ever come after Crayola for calling something champagne, or if Crayola ever has tried. But they have successfully barred the use of the word champagne in connection with toothpastes, mineral water for pets. That's a good one. Because your pet really needs a champagne experience in its mineral water. Toilet paper, underwear, and shoes. So this is coming from coverage over at The Local, which is a French news en anglais. Mary, any thoughts?
No, this just cracks me up. And it looks like this all happened, you know, a month or two ago. So somehow the possible champagne number leaked out, or name leaked out there. And now if you go on the website, they actually don't tell you the name of the color, but it's gold, apparently. If you do the little, you know, inspect element, it's gold. So it sounds like Apple gave this one up pretty quickly.
All righty. Hey, I think we have another guest joining us, Chris Versace from Power Talk and the Power Trend Brief. Chris, you're back in business. You have power.
We have power, yeah. Sorry about everything.
Power up, power trend. That's a good thing. No worries. We're glad we could get you on the show.
Power trends out of power, huh?
Sorry?
Works out well.
I was saying it's not good when power trends is out of power.
No, not good at all. So we're glad that you're back in business. We've been talking about a lot of privacy-related stories thus far, but we just moved into something related to the iPhone, aside from its biometrics. And what's your take on the whole iPhone announcement? Is this the beginning of the end of Apple's dominance of the phone market?
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of people are focusing in on, you know, these two models, which, from my perspective, were a little underwhelming, okay? Yeah, if there was a little bit more that Apple showed, for example, with the 5S, you know, combining the fingerprint recognition with a robust mobile payment system, that would get people excited about Apple. But what you have to do is, you know, when it comes to Apple, you have to dig a little deeper. And there was something in their announcement for iOS 7. It was iOS in the car that I found far more interesting than looking at, you know, the latest and greatest iPhone models. And I say that because we're seeing mobile really start to move beyond smartphones, beyond tablets. There's a growing amount of talk about the connected car, the connected home. And to me, this is a lot more interesting. There's a number of ways that investors can play it, but we're in the early stages here. And it's interesting to me because we're at a time when smartphones are starting to eclipse regular mobile phone sales, tablets are starting to eclipse PC sales. So at some point, people are going to start saying, okay, these markets are now going to be driven by replacement demand. So what's the new thing? And Denise, I'm telling you, the new thing is the connected car and the connected home.
So there's a really good article and whole section in the current Wired magazine about device design and devices working with one another. And, you know, the fact that when you get a new device in your life, it shouldn't throw the whole ecosystem into turmoil because it doesn't communicate with what else you have. And it uses as an example the way that cars now can pretty efficiently make a handshake with your phone, provide you with all the phone features that you need while you are driving in a way that makes sense for you when you're driving, and then the two of them part ways when you're done with that experience. Do you think that that's what Apple has in mind, or are they attempting to come in and sort of take over the car experience?
Well, I think it's going to go one step further. I mean, we've had pairing via Bluetooth for some time. Whether it was your contacts, the ability to call someone on the fly in the car. What Apple's talking about is using the phone, connecting it presumably through Bluetooth, but allowing you to use its map apps on your screens, allowing you to use Siri while you're driving. And if we think about some of the upgrades that Apple is doing for Siri, obviously better voice quality, voice recognition, but also really integrating Siri into some of the other applications that it has, that I think is taking us one step further. Remember, there's a lot of concern out there with people doing too many things with their phone or tablet while they're driving. You know, texting, for example, you know, surfing the internet. And, you know, just as an aside, I do wonder what all this means for Google Glass. I know that West Virginia is really looking at the implications of Google Glass as it relates to drivers, and it's not looking like it's very positive. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, Denise, I do think that we're going to start seeing a lot more in terms of robust services to the car. And I don't know if you've mentioned this or not, but AT&T is working with a number of auto manufacturers, including GM, Ford, and others, as is Verizon Wireless, to bring high-speed LTE connectivity into the car. So we really have to start thinking about what that means.
Right. And that, I mean, that's just the next logical step, I think. I think the days of, you know, people have had monitors in their back seats for their kids for a long time, but you've only been able to, you haven't had a whole lot of flexibility of what you could put on those monitors if you don't have online access in the car. So unless you're just going to tote a hotspot around with you all the time, having somebody partner up with the car and provide internet access, of course, you have the whole distracted driver problem when you start putting a whole lot of internet into the car. But not everyone in the car is driving. So I do think that's a logical step. Evan, do you think any of this is headed for a debacle of product liability and or personal injury lawsuits?
Well, there's every reason to think that there could be more of this coming along. It was just a couple of weeks ago we were talking about that case in New Jersey, the liability for sending the text to the driver that you knew was distracted. You know, that's mm-hmm. just one flavor of how tort law can be in the context of new technologies. There's nothing novel about that technology at all. You know, it's just simple SMS technology. You know, it just really makes it more complex, much more opportunities for things to go wrong in this notion of bringing automobiles into the Internet of Things, and not only the informational aspects of it, you know, the data privacy aspects of it, and you know, this knowledge. I mean, I think we could bring into the periphery out here data stored in, you know, the black boxes, accident reconstruction, a lot of things a lot of consequences of that. So there's no doubt that this will present some new questions, and the more connectivity there is, the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong, and that's where these interesting issues will present themselves.
Okay, and Chris, thanks so much for hitting on that notion. It's not something that I had seen in the coverage of Apple's announcement. Like you said, I don't think too many people have been paying attention to that whole car tie-in, but that could be a very big deal. What has been tickling my funny bone since the word that Twitter is going to file for its IPO is that Twitter will have a quiet period. Sort of the antithesis of a company that you expect to be able to make it through its quiet period.
You're referring, Denise, to the secret filing that they're doing that everybody seems to know about.
Yes. How is this secret? I know about it. You know about it. What goes on?
Bring us up to speed.
Yes. They tweeted about it, right?
Yeah, no, they did. They did. And it's an interesting way that they're going about it because, you know, they're filing to go public, much like Facebook did. And, you know, the mechanism that they're using allows for them to file incrementally. And it's looking as if they could actually go public in a transaction led by Goldman Sachs either late this year, or early 2014. So I think that, you know, we'll see the initial S-1. We'll see a lot more addendums to it with a lot more information. I, for one, am rather curious to see exactly how does Twitter really make money? What percent of it is derived, you know, from, you know, not just smartphones, but really from these new platforms that they're working on. You know, there's a lot of chatter about Twitter and TV. But, you know, at the end of the day, we need to understand Twitter's ability to monetize. And if you remember Facebook going public, there's a lot of questions about where they were positioned in mobile, how would they turn around and monetize that asset. And coming out of the June quarter, some 41% of their revenues came from mobile. You know, and Twitter, if you think about it, is really a mobile platform at the heart of everything else. So I think it's going to be a very interesting transaction to watch. But the bigger question for me is which exchange is going to get the listing, the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange? And I say that because the NASDAQ, you know, in my words, bungled the Facebook IPO, and they've had a number of outages of late.
So help people understand how that choice gets made. It's up to Twitter to decide where they're going to list, correct?
That is, well, as part of going public, they do have to list on an exchange. And it used to be there were a number of exchanges here in the U.S. You would have had the American Stock Exchange, for example, the New York Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ. Now, the NASDAQ tends to be home to a lot of tech companies, you know, Google, Apple, you know, Broadcom, Qualcomm, so on and so forth. Whereas the New York Stock Exchange is kind of a older legacy, more established, some would say stodgier companies. You know, that's where you see your Procter & Gamble's, your Colgate-Palmolive's, your McDonald's, your IBM's, that sort of thing. And, you know, no, make no mistake, these guys very aggressively, both at the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, try to win new business. You know, so you are right, Denise. It is up to Twitter to decide. And just like the investment bankers were pitching Twitter to take them public, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ are going to be pitching. The question is, given those things that I mentioned, you know, really blowing the Facebook IPO, a number of outages of late, you know, I think that this would be a real coup for the New York Stock Exchange to win. And I think that would, you know, be a step towards revitalizing their image with the technology companies that, you know, predominantly are on the West Coast.
Wouldn't it be ironic if Twitter hit on that issue that you just raised? Oh, you're having too many outages. I don't think that we'll list with you. Yes, Twitter's original quiet period was every time you used to see the fail whale.
Yes. That actually is very funny, though, considering, you know, Twitter does go down from time to time, as does Gmail and some of Apple services, too. It's unfortunately one of those things that in this always on, always connected world that I always talk about, you know, remember, we used to have dial up and that was great. And now all of a sudden, you know, the minute our high speed broadband goes down or another service we have goes down, oh, my God, I can't believe it. This is crazy.
Right. Or some construction crew knocks out your power. Just never
tell
know.
Tell me about
force,
it.
And, force and, majeure, and once again.
Not get online. I mean, if you think about that, your telephone line is down, your broadband is down. And if you're, you know, kind of thinking that you may charge your iPhone in a little while, like I was, you don't even have an iPhone anymore if you're out of power. So it's, you know, at the end of the day, power is still one of those pain points that we have to deal with. And, you know, if you think about, you know, batteries in particular for our iPhones, our tablets, if there was some way to really have a battery on steroids, I think we would all like that. That would be a great investment.
So my question for our lawyers, my fellow lawyers on the panel, Mary and Evan, we've talked a lot on the show, Evan, about Twitter and the fact that one of its selling points is its approach toward privacy, ironically, the fact that it refuses government requests to access data about users. It fights them. It's very transparent about those kinds of requests. Do you think that as Twitter begins to position itself as what will eventually be a public company, that that'll be a big consideration in people's perception and desire to buy stock?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I get the sense that people buy stock for more objective reasons. It's a little bit of a touchy-feely reason there. And yes, there are sensibilities that drive people to buy stock that are based on the public interest, you know, environmentally friendly companies. Perhaps their bottom line is affected by that. I just think it's probably too complex of an analysis to think in the mind of the investor that that's going to be something that will really make a big difference in you know, for large institutional investors or, you know, people putting, piling a lot of money in this. But, you know, this is just me kind of, you know, jabbering from the sidelines about this. It wouldn't make a, for me personally in making an investment decision, that wouldn't, that would weigh into it slightly, but it wouldn't really be the end of the day or, you know, the end of the determination of where I lay the money down.
It'll be
the reason found. I get emails, you know, everybody gets emails from various sources. And one that sort of popped up on my radar the other day is from the Reason Foundation. And they did a poll. 6 in 10 Americans, they found 61% do not trust Facebook at all to protect their privacy or personal information. So that's why I ask about Twitter, that, you know, if Facebook is having stock issues, certainly not as they did when they did their IPO, but if they have public perception issues that can impact the stock price, that maybe Twitter will be positioned differently. What do you think, Chris?
Hold on 1 second. I'm calling him back.
Oh, okay. Mary, how about you? Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it'll be, you know, when Google went public, they went out of their way to say, we are still going to do some of the things that we did as a non-public company that, you know, may be different than what you see most public companies doing. We're going to think for the long term. We're not going to gun for each quarter. You know, we may do things that investors don't like in the short run. It'd be really interesting to see if Twitter does anything similar to that on this issue or any other, but say, you know, we're going to continue our stance to fight these things that you may think in the short run might not be so great for shareholder value, but are absolutely part of kind of our trust with our community and part of our brand, and be fascinating. And I'm also, I was at Yahoo in the, you know, Overture business, the paid search business, when Google went public. And it, I love thinking about all of the people at Twitter's competitors now just sort of chomping at the bit, waiting to see those initial filings so that you can, you know, get as much competitive intelligence on this company that's been able to be totally secretive up till now. I'm sure that that's happening here. It certainly happened when Google went public.
So, Chris, I don't know. I think you dropped off just as I was reading this stat from a poll of the Reason Foundation that found that 61% of Americans don't trust Facebook at all with their data. Do you think that Twitter's different approach to, first of all, making pretty much everything you do on the service, with some minor exceptions, such as you and I DMing each other this morning, a public experience from the get-go, and also having such a user-focused approach toward protecting user data, do you think that that'll make a difference for them?
Well, you know, it's funny. With Twitter, it's kind of a different service in my view. And I have to be honest with you, my Facebook account got hacked. So I actually got deactivated and I haven't started it up again. But I've kept my Twitter account. And the reason I do that is Twitter to me is a fantastic information aggregator. You know, the amount of things that I can learn, track, even search, if you use Twitter or its product TweetDeck, it's phenomenal. But I don't see people putting the same amount of personal things on there, like your birth date, who your friends are, who you're connected. You're not broadcasting all sorts of personal information on Twitter. You can if you want in different ways, but it's not quite that uber social experience and kind of social gateway that Facebook is becoming. So I think that Twitter is probably a little more insulated from that. That's a layperson's perspective, I realize. But on the plus side, you know, Twitter has done certain things to implement two-step authentication that I think make people feel a little more comfortable with it. But having said all that, look, have I gotten DMs or direct messages from people, you know, whose accounts have been hacked? I have. And I unfortunately think, you know, that level of security, it may not be 100%. And I think we've got to be prepared for that. But as you hear parents telling kids, you know, when you write an email, when you post something, be it on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, you need to think that it is out there and it will be out there forever. And it can have implications. So think twice.
All right. Chris, that was very insightful. And I hope that folks could hear it well. Your mic is a little bit in and out. You might want to either put it closer to your mouth or unplug it and replug it in. Because we're kind of getting some intermittent dropouts on your audio there. So We'll try and work on that. What other interesting stock-related things can we talk about? Another, you know, you don't necessarily think about how small things can affect things down the road, whether or not a state has non-compete contracts that are legally enforceable can make a difference to whether companies want to do business there. Massachusetts is making a move in that direction to try and lure businesses to its market. Evan, do you think they'll be successful?
It's an interesting ploy. You know, there's especially with this idea of what California has done, and I'll leave that for the two of you to talk, you and Mary, to talk about what's going on in California with non-compete agreements. But you know, this is a problem, and it's a particular issue that can affect businesses' decisions in hiring. So it's interesting to see something at the state level, you know, happening with that. I know Mary had some interesting comments about this as well, or interesting thoughts about it.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I hadn't focused on the fact that Massachusetts was so different from California on this front. And it seems funny to me that this is happening so late, considering that, you know, there actually is a lot of technology in Massachusetts and, you know, coming from Massachusetts. I do think probably the bigger issue than non-competes is just, you know, critical mass of the community that people want to be close to when they're starting things up. But I can't imagine this will hurt if they manage to make this change. It seems like, you know, one more thing that prevents it from being a disadvantage to being there.
Right. Can you explain to us what California does? My working understanding of California law on this is that non-competes are only enforceable in very limited circumstances. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I am happy to say that I'm not in an employment lawyer, but this does come up with clients of ours from time mm-hmm. to time. That's same thing. There's these very limited circumstances where non-compete will be upheld, you know, in the context of where you're selling a business or something along those lines. But aside mm-hmm. from that, it's not a state where you can very easily keep people from starting or going to a competitive business. And, you know, so people can move around far more easily.
Right. So it's funny. It's one of those instances, getting back to, you know, what your clients might put in their contracts to limit their liability in the event they get knocked on the door by the FBI or the NSA or anyone else. Oftentimes you see non-compete language in people's employment agreements, but it's just sort of, you know, it could be because they were drafted in another state, but when they're intended to be enforced in California, it's really funny to even see them there, because you may as well just write them in invisible ink. In most of the cases, they're not going to be enforced.
Yeah, and it can get very sticky, because when you've got a non-compete, you probably have a non-solicit and other kinds of, you know, sort of similar clauses that are meant to keep you from, you know, really getting a toehold in doing business against your former employer. And how enforceable each of those things is in California, if it's written under, you know, a different state's law, because say your employer is headquartered somewhere else, that can get a little tricky. But on the whole, California, for employees and for your ability to go and do what you want after you've left one job, has been an unusually good place to be. Although, you know, maybe it won't have that as an advantage compared to other states, at least as in Massachusetts, sometime soon.
I wonder what if there's Illinois, much.
I was wondering what Illinois does, Evan.
Illinois, you know, it's kind of with the majority. We don't do crazy stuff here like what you do out in California. You know, I mean, non-compete provisions can be enforceable so long as they're reasonable in their duration and in their geographic scope. So, you know, Illinois has got its own slew of fiscal problems, you know, so, mm-hmm. you know, this issue here, you know, if there's any business left in 10 years in Illinois, it won't be because of the state of the law when it comes to non-compete agreements here. So I'm curious to know whether there's been any empirical research. I'm sure there has, but whether there's any, you know, good empirical research done on this issue here of what the effect is on a company and its ability to retain good workers, and in tension with its desire to retain its trade secrets and its competitive advantage. Because, you know, if it weren't, if a non-compete provision weren't beneficial to a company's interest in keeping its intelligence there and prohibiting knowledgeable workers going to work for someone else, a competitor is the big concern, these provisions wouldn't have come up in the first place. And to the extent that the law is drawn back on them, and the law serves to prohibit them, that seems to be a natural detriment to the company's interests. So, it would be really interesting to see what the economic effect of this is on balance, because it seems to me there are two columns here. There's the benefit to the employees and the benefit to the companies, and you can't take from one without giving to the other, and vice versa. So, interesting thing I'm thinking about on this.
Well, it's tempting to confuse putting in a requirement that you may not go work for a competitor after you leave one job in an industry. It's tempting to confuse that with misappropriating your company's trade secrets and using them at a new job. And they're not the same thing, are they?
No. I mean, trade secret information that's subject to trade secret protection is narrower in scope than everything else that the employee knows. And so I trust that even in these situations where non-compete provisions are unlawful, or they're not enforceable, I guess would be the better way of saying it, that doesn't mm-hmm. do anything to diminish the enforceability of claims under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act or whatever, or the common law, or whatever the trade secret statute is. But they're still right. of the same ilk, you know. They're still of yeah. the same, you know, pro employer, pro business perspective, and they would just have to have an effect somehow.
Well, it's interesting because I practiced for a while on the East Coast in telecommunications, and there you always had to be concerned, you know, when I was in-house and when my employer would hire somebody, one of the first questions was, you know, where's the guy from? Is it a competitive business? You know, is there anything in his employment contract that would get us into hot water? But also you had to be concerned about whether there was this, you know, inevitable disclosure, meaning that, you know, he can't pretend to not know the trade secrets of the employer he's coming from. And if those trade secrets are directly, you know, implicated in what he's doing for the new employer, then you might have a confidentiality or, you know, trade secret misappropriation problem. And so you bring people right. in and have them do something else, you know, and flip burgers in the cafeteria for 6 months and then go to their real job. And, you know, that kind of thing, because California doesn't have an inevitable disclosure doctrine, it is also very different out here. That it, again, just on that theme of employees being able to move more freely, there's less concern, I guess, about, you know, needing to put somebody on ice for a while to overcome that inevitable disclosure problem.
Right. Hey, I think we got Chris back, and I wanted to, before we wrap up talking about our stories from the rundown and the links that you guys can check out on Delicious, just check with him and see, you know, we've talked about Twitter and Facebook a bit today. The Jobs Act is something that we pay attention to on the show and have talked about quite a bit as it starts to play out and get more clarification from the SEC as to how it will work. Is there anything else on your mind about these various issues that we can go into real briefly here before we wrap up the show?
Sure. I mean, there's always stuff to talk about. You know, there's always the state of the economy. There's, you know, you mentioned Obamacare without calling it quite that, and what its impact is going to be. There's, I don't know if you guys touched on something that happened in California, which was the raising of the minimum wage over 3 years to about $10, one of the most expensive in the country, and what the impact of that is going to be on business and subsequently, you know, the stocks of publicly traded companies. So, I mean, there's a whole kit and caboodle of stuff out there. Probably, I would think, you know, Obamacare is a big one, and it sounds as if that there's more pushback, including the AFL-CIO turning around and no longer supporting it. At least that's what it seems to be. To me, that's a pretty big deal. and it sounds like that, you know, we could see some major revisions, potentially even the AFL-CIO is, if I understand it correctly, is calling for the rejection of Obamacare. And it was interesting, too, to me that the longshoremen have already said that they're not going to go along with it. So it's interesting that as we get closer and closer to me, in terms of the timing, in terms of not only implementation, but the exchanges having to be up, that there seems to be a tremendous amount of pushback. And again, not only from groups like the AFL-CIO, but other businesses out there, even ones that aren't public, like a Trader Joe's, for example, is talking about suspending healthcare benefits and things like that. So it's just very interesting to me that this is going to come to a head at a time, and again, I'm putting my investor hat on, where we've got some uncertainty that's building once again over Syria. We've got the Federal Open Market Committee meeting next week to let us know if the Fed will start to taper the stimulative efforts. Remember, they've been buying $85 billion in bonds a month, and they're going to start to slow that down. And then, of course, we've got the debt ceiling and the potential government shutdown that we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks. So there's a number of issues that are coming. From an investor's perspective, it seems to me that we'll be looking at a wall of uncertainty once again.
Well, that's disappointing, but thank you for your insights there. We need to put our second MCLE passphrase into the show, and in honor of the champagne-colored iPhones that will no longer be called champagne, let's make our second passphrase for the show Champagne Supernova, at Mary's suggestion. And also, in homage to our discussion of the Twitter IPO, I noticed earlier that Hugh McLeod had a funny little commentary on that in his daily cartoon today. There you go, if you're watching the video. The various hashtags and at messages that someone might tweet out for Follow Friday on the day that we learn of Twitter's IPO, including greed, avarice, jealousy, gossip, billionaires, etc. So he always manages to nail the zeitgeist of the breaking tech news. And we have some great resources and a tip for you. We'll start with the tip. This is a story over at The Verge and a video that Disney released encouraging viewers of the Little Mermaid movie to bring their iPads in to a screening of that movie and have a whole interactive experience. Maybe we'll play the video before I give you the tip.
Going has never been so much fun.
Jumpy jellyfish.
Interact with the film and compete with the audience. Play games. Find hidden treasure. Sing along.
Sing with me now.
But watch out, because you never know who will be trying to steal your voice.
That's what I do. It's what I live for.
So the other thing to watch out for, and this comes from Fred Von Lohman. He tweeted the link to this. The other thing to watch out for when you bring your iPad in and have this interactive experience in the movie is, of course, it and your phone and various other devices that you're packing into the movie theater probably have cameras on them. So, you know, don't just watch out for someone trying to steal your voice. Disney's still going to watch out for you trying to steal their movie. So, you know, don't film the mermaids is our tip for this week. Be careful not to use your iPad in a way that would make it not just an entertainment device, but a device where you yourself are making photographs or videos. If you're going to take Disney up on its offer. And then our resources of the week, a couple of interesting things for you. One is Steam, the online video gaming network, has something in beta that's going to be available soon. It's called Steam Family Sharing. And so it's sort of taking an approach the opposite of many of the companies that we talk about on the show, where we're discussing their restrictive licensing strategy and how games are locked up or DRM'd in one way or another. What Steam is doing is instead, if you have family members or friends who enjoy playing the same games that you do, you can play one another's games. You can authorize other computers to play the games on your account. Now, it's not a perfect system. You can have 10, up to 10 devices authorized on your account. And if you happen to be playing, that person that you've authorized can't play at the same time. So it's not simultaneous, and people are going to have to take their turn in using the games this way. But it's kind of an interesting sharing strategy to see the company adopting. So if you're a gamer, you might want to check that out. And then a resource for our security and policy wonks out there in the self-same current issue of Wired magazine. They have a great section called 101 Signals, only the very best of the web on various topics that they've culled out. Twig this week in Google made one of their subtopics there. I forget if it was business or consumer technology, but props to Twig for getting on there. I wish Twill had gotten into the government and security section, but we have no sour grapes about that. And we think that they have a wonderful selection of stuff here for you guys to check out, including EFF's Deep Links blog, IP Watch, and the venerable SCOTUS blog and Volok Conspiracy, all things that we read all the time, and you should too. So check out this great list over at Wired. And with that, I'd love to thank our great panel for today. Chris, thank you so much for soldiering through your power issues and giving us your thoughts here today.
Well, happy to do it, and hopefully we can do it again.
Yeah, we'd love that. Get you on in under better circumstances, both with the mic and the power and everything else, and get you on for the whole show. All right. And tell us about your Power Trend Brief. Where can people find that and get more information from you about investing and your insights along those lines?
Sure. So for anybody who wants to follow what I'm saying about the market or some of these other things that we're talking about, they can. It's very simple. They can go to chrisversace.com, and there's several tabs. One for Power Talk, which is much like your show, Denise. Mine's a long format interview, one-on-one with CEOs and other movers and shakers in the world of business. And there's also some other tabs there. One that has my investment newsletter, Power Trend Profits. And you can also sign up for a free weekly e-letter where I share the latest and greatest thoughts that I have, as it were, on the economy, the market, the political impact, and all that stuff. So, again, chrisversace.com. Well,
and when we have you back on, too, I want to get your take on the telecommunications and video communications industries more than we were able to get into this week, sure. Because very interesting stuff going on there. Mary Grant, such a pleasure to meet you. Great having you on the show.
Great to be here. My total pleasure.
So tell us if there's anything going on where folks can see more of you, have more of your insights into things.
So we are on the verge of doing some things like that. Right now, we're just trying to keep all of the balls in the air for our clients. But we're at grantlawinc.com. Mm-hmm. And we do more one-on-one right now.
That's good. We like clients having their needs attended to. I'm sure they like it too. Evan, you are constantly busy attending to the needs of your clients and writing great stuff on the InfoLaw Group blog and on internetcases.com. So we appreciate that.
I try my best. Thanks for reading it. Yeah, it's blogging is a great thing because you can kind of do it when it presents itself, when interesting things come up, and there's always something to talk about. So yeah, I try to do what I can and keep it in balance.
Great. Well, we're so thrilled that all of you could join us here today on episode 227 of This Week in Law. If you've been joining us live for the show, thank you so much. We do record the show Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. But if you can't join us live, don't worry. We're going to be there for you in all sorts of ways. If you have a Roku, we have a channel there. If you're an iTunes user, we're there in the podcast section in both video and audio form. Our backlog of episodes, our archive of episodes is at the twit.tv site at twit.tv/twill. You can find all kinds of good information there. And of course, there's that TwitWiki if you're interested in more information about continuing legal education credit, since we do delve into the latest decisions and laws that affect the worlds of technology. So check that out too. And we couldn't do this show without the active participation of our wonderful audience, both while we are recording and while we're off the air. So to get in touch with us when we're not broadcasting here on twit.tv, please email Evan at evan.twit.tv or me, I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can find both of us on Twitter. Also, the show has a Facebook page and a Google Plus page where we love to have your thoughts about things we should discuss on the show and do some fleshing out of those ideas and what people are most interested in. So hit us up in any of those places, and please do so before next Friday, if you would, when we will be back. And we're looking forward to seeing you then. Take care.